Good morning, everybody. my job is to talk about sustainable low-cost cow wintering in Alberta, Canada, and it's a very short season area compared to what we've been talking about. I'm going to have a short introduction. I'm going to speak about 50% of my talk will be about money that can be saved in winter grazing as opposed to feeding cows in a feedlot. Then we'll talk about the relationships among yield, carrying capacity, and cost, importance of forage quality in extending the grazing season, keeping cows on pasture longer during the winter saves more money, and then impacts of winter grazing on sustainability. The area that we're talking about is the western Canadian prairies, and the prairies, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta represent about 80% of the beef cow herd in Canada. Saskatchewan and Alberta represent 70% of those beef cows. The area of densest beef cow production is this area here surrounding the Lacombe area. Borders are Calgary in the south, Edmonton in the north. It's generally a parkland area, and it's typified in the entire prairie region, although we have a semi-arid region in the south and parkland in the north. It's a very short season, cool, dry area. Short growing season. So in the middle of the 1990s, the federal government in Canada and the Alberta government combined to look at research priorities. And we conducted a number of focus groups. And one of the most important priorities for the beef industry was to reduce the high cost of overwintering the beef cow. Hence, a lot of my talk is going to be about reducing costs. Currently, the cost of feed bedding and pasture represent 56 to 71% of the production costs of a beef calf, and about 38% of that cost is winter feed. Currently, the daily cost of winter feeding is increasing, and the cost of land on which we grow the feed, not the summer pasture that the beef industry is centered on, but where we grow the feed, that cost of land is increasing. Just to give you an idea about what the cost of winter feeding is in Canada, the daily cost is what we're going to talk about, has increased from about $2 a day in the 90s and early 2000s to about $3 a day currently. And that winter cost, the daily cost, is about 50-50 difference between the cost of actually producing the feed and servicing the cows as they're being fed in a feedlot or a feeding site. That's contrasted with the summer pasture, which is about 75 cents a day, and then this extended grazing, and I got this information from Roy Arnott, a farm economist in Manitoba. His extended grazing scenario here is to use the second cut of a two-cut hay graze system, which is quite typical on the Canadian prairies, probably would be a smooth brome grass alfalfa stand used for hay and then grazing later. So we talked about the cost of winter grazing and summer grazing. How many days are we talking about? These three pie charts typify scenarios that might occur in the three prairie provinces. And in fact, while each province has its numbers that it uses, all of these scenarios could occur in any province in any year. That's how variable our climate is. So the Alberta Cow-Calf Manual might say that producers should prepare for 200 days of winter feeding. So that would tell you that we must have 165 days of pasture. Well, we don't have 165 days of growth. So pasture production or crop production begins in early May or late April, and we may have 60 to 90 days of effective growth, where the growth of dry matter production can keep up to the demand of the cow. But from mid-July on until October at weaning time, probably pastures and perennial forages can't keep up with the daily demands of the cow and calf. So in a sense, this is no fault of anybody. We have C3 species, and those species are limited in growth at that time through drought or dry weather, high and low temperature, and we have to have dormancy coming on to prepare the perennials for winter. So everything is driving those crops towards low productivity. In order to overcome that, we can plant annual crops during the regular cropping season on different land to support growth later or even winter grazing. We can also grow crops that are improved for regrowth from the perennial side. So methods that we might use for extending the grazing season, we've looked at since the mid-1990s, and each of these experiments takes about 4 or 5 years to do and a limited number of treatments. But we've looked at stockpile grazing of perennial forage and stocker systems and in winter grazing and compared that to something called swath grazing. So swath grazing, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about it in this talk, are crops that are planted specifically for grazing during the winter, beginning usually in November, grazing through until March if we can. So this would be a barley swath. This is an experimental trial that we may have conducted. We have grazing as limited every day, and the wheels move forward. These are Gallagher tumble wheels, and they have a polywire through them, and so cows graze on these until they've consumed most of the forage. Maybe we move cows twice a week, and some producers will move it every day. We've also looked at corn as a source of winter feed. Bale grazing is quite popular. Bale grazing has been adopted by about 33% of producers. The objective there is twofold. Bale grazing is not as inexpensive as swath grazing or stockpile grazing, but large round bales are produced in another area on the farm and brought and placed strategically to old grass pastures in particular. And so cost is reduced to a certain extent, but also the nutrients left from grazing and the residues from the hay bales help restore productivity on the old grass pasture. I use these system relationships because, as Darren said, we're talking about some really complicated issues here when we talk about integrated crop programs. And so how do you integrate the pasture terminology and pasture data that we have to deal with into our final inputs, our final outcomes, which are reducing costs, for example. So when we started out, we were focusing on daily cost, and we still are because we do farmer-directed research. And if you don't show a difference in cost due to your research, you're probably not going to get funded again. So we focused on daily cost, and the drivers for that daily cost is carrying capacity and the feed cost. So the denominator for the daily cost is going to be carrying capacity, and if we maintain it as high as possible, then that's good. The cost components are the feed cost of the feed that we grow, and then the yardage or the servicing cost of the winter of feeding. So it's more or less a constant cost, but both are reduced by carrying capacity. So when we first started doing work, we would have been really happy if all we could do is reduce the cost of harvest, hauling, and processing and manure removal, which we wanted to do. That was our goal. But we really didn't get too far in reducing the feed costs. The only way that we can do that is increase yield, and you see on the first line of the equation for carrying capacity, you have to have a high yield or you're not going to have a high carrying capacity. So you have to look at yield within the context of the system that you have, and we had swath grazing here and we were using barley. and our target was to maximize yield and maximize potential carrying capacity by the yield of barley or small grains reaching the dough stage by mid to late September. In addition to that, so we would have yield and consumptive yield when we take utilization into account, but on top of that, we have to maintain a high or a low maintenance requirement. In other words, by keeping forage quality high or choosing species with high forage quality or quality that was resistant to weathering loss, less dry daily dry matter would be required. Divided into the consumptive yield gives you a high carrying capacity. And then finally, this whole business of utilization during winter grazing is really important. A low utilization means a high low consumptive yield and therefore a low daily cost. So our research is built around those relationships. Now looking, breaking down the cost versus different systems that are available, and I should say if we look at the accumulation of all of these systems, the adoption rate now over about the last 10 to 15 years has been about 50%. In other words, 50% of beef producers are using them, more than one or two, or have used them. The yardage values, the yardage cost broken down on a daily basis, or I use often 100 cows for 100 days because it represents a cow herd. Half of the cost of a traditional pen-fed system will be a yardage cost. So most of these systems, residues through straw buncher, swath graze, stockpile, or bale graze, are effective in reducing that yardage cost because of not feeding, not hauling manure away, etc. It's a bit harder to reduce the feed cost, but in future that's what we have to do, meaning we have to get the crop physiology, crop management, and agronomy down to maintain high yields. In that regard, we carried out a study where we were focusing on the effect of planting date on yield. In order to harvest our swath or harvest our small grains in September reaching the dough stage, we have to alter the planting date to what it would be if we were planting normally. A normal planting date would be the first week in May. If we're using barley and targeting the middle of September for harvest, we probably have to plant as late as the last week in June or first week in July. So this study had seven planting dates, and with six row barley varieties, you can see that the yield was reduced by planting late by about 40%. When we translate that into carrying capacity, we have about 600 cow days per hectare. So we wanted to look at varieties or species which were more resistant to planting date versus yield. And we found that both oats and triticale maintained yield at a fairly high level. Problem with oats is that its low forage quality counterproductive with regard to carrying capacity, but triticale maintained quality and yield. So that allowed us to move this on into grazing trials where we compared barley swath, corn swath, and triticale swath with a pen-fed control. And so you see, averaged over 5 years, we had a 50% higher yield with spring triticale planted about the last week in May versus our barley swath, which was planted sometime around the middle of June. Corn was planted early in May and had a 30% yield advantage over barley. The feed cost, or the cost per hectare of producing the feed, was almost twice as much for corn as barley, but because of its higher yield and carrying capacity, we were able to have a significantly lower daily cost and about half the cost of the control. The high yield of the triticale allowed us to get down to about 75 cents a day. So the savings over a 100-day period would be relatively large. And because we had higher yield, we were really aware of this increasing our yield and carrying capacity, we're able to reduce the amount of land required to feed 100 cows for 100 days in the winter. Also, we wanted to look at the really inexpensive methods for wintering cows and stockpiled grass. The second cut of a two-cut system grazed on an area basis was extremely inexpensive compared to the other crops. We compared this to swath oats, and the daily cost as a result of that ended up being the same, because the carrying capacity and yield of the stockpile grass was about a third of the oats, and the offsetting factors meant that we had essentially the same cost. The problem with using stockpiled grass or regrowth that is not superior regrowth, if we depended on that for 100 cows for 100 days grazing, it would take a substantial quantity of land. We reduced the amount of land required with oat swath, and it's about the same as using small grain barley. If we calculate this through to feeding hay from the same land as the stockpiled grain, the daily cost would be about the same as the control. And if we had about a 50 days of grazing and 50 days of hay feeding, we'd have an intermediate cost. So the longer we can continue growth and the higher the yield we have, the better off we're going to be. The relationship between yield and carrying capacity is highly linear and very tight. Basically, higher yield you can get, higher carrying capacity you will have. There's a looser relationship with the daily feeding cost and carrying capacity. But maintaining yields and carrying capacity in these systems is extremely important. They may be holistic, but we still have to maintain good agronomics and high yields. Factors affecting cow energy balance during the winter really impact the number of days that we can continue to graze in the winter towards calving. And things like the demand for energy on a daily basis for maintenance are well known. We know that pregnancy advances and that we get a rapid increase in the energy requirement as we get close to calving. What we don't know a whole lot about is the extra energy required for foraging, and we think that we would top up the other two with about a 20% increase in energy requirement, simply because it's a lot of work to graze. From the supply side, we need to look at species with high initial forage quality and species that can maintain that quality. Utilization becomes important because it's difficult to graze through snow. We can't really impact that through the crop, except that high yielding crops have big swaths and are easier to access through snow. Body condition score is really important as well on cows. Looking at the energy requirements of cows during her cow year is shown here, and we're most interested in this area here from weaning on to calving. And if we're calving in late February or early March, we are weaning in October or November. During this first part of the after weaning, the cow energy requirement per day might be 10 or 11 megacals per day. And that's relatively easy to achieve under pretty good weather conditions, and the demands of pregnancy are not really that high. But once we get into the December-January period, those are our coldest months and months of deepest snow, the demands of pregnancy really increase, and it's conceivable that a cow can be in an energy deficit of about 5 megacals per day. So a 640 kilogram cow with a body condition with using the American system of about 6 could supply from her body reserves about 300 megacals if we use an entire body condition. But it's possible for the cow to be under an energy deficit from swath grazing of about 5 a day, and so that body reserve from 6 to 5 would last about 2 months. And so it's not uncommon that we do lose some weight, necessitating cows being at a high body condition score before we start. So how do crops fit within this weathering scheme and in terms of supplying that energy? Well, we've carried out a study over the last 3 years, and this is a summary of it, and I've fitted linear regressions to forage quality, and here we're using TDN. And looking at that energy requirement throughout the winter period, we see a relatively low TDN is required early on, increasing to about 54% as we get into the December-January period, but then requiring in the last 60 days a very high quantity. And really only corn was able to accomplish that throughout the whole period. I'm going to have to move quickly through this. We see that the relationship between forage quality or IVTD and quality can make a big difference in weight loss of cows. Stockpile grass is one of the winners, as well as corn in this regard, of maintaining body condition. Finally, we could spend the entire talk talking about the impacts on sustainability. Improvements in land used in beef systems, reduced labor, reduced fossil fuel and energy, reduced greenhouse gases, and the impacts of nutrient carryover. Summing up some of the results that we have here, and they're really important to beef systems and beef farmers, we see that labor, particularly in this winter feeding period, is really reduced. Diesel fuel, and this is just diesel fuel, not all energy, is reduced to about 25% of what we would use in normal systems. In terms of economics, we're saving 100 cows for 100 days. If we average barley, triticale, and corn, we're saving about $9,500. And if we're really aware of good agronomics, we can save some land. Using life cycle analysis, we looked at the amount of energy and greenhouse gases we improved, and I will quickly just say that in terms of all energy uses, which includes diesel fuel and inputs, we can save about 50% of energy. Crops that are higher yielding, like triticale, have a higher energy efficiency than those that yield less. Greenhouse gas emission on total emission, again, life cycle analysis using IPCC 2006. We've recently published this, and we've made actual measurements as well as modeled this sort of thing. So our treatments with swath grazing were somewhat more efficient in terms of total greenhouse gas emission, meaning energy, CO2, enteric and manure methane, and nitrous oxide. Our big saving really in terms of comparatively was in the energy area, and this is the amount of diesel fuel that we would save on an emission basis. These are percentages. So cow-based greenhouse gas emissions in this system was about 80% for the animal and about 20% for the crop. Winter grazing systems leave residues in manure, and they leave more residues than you would get in silage systems or in hay systems. And we would typically get about 2,500 to 3,000 kilograms per hectare of above ground residue left from these. So handling residues are difficult, but they do add to the carbon pool. Nutrient application through bale grazing is shown here, and you can see the bales are strategically placed in the field. This is the first spring after bale grazing. There are residue left, and there's carryover effects for about 2 to 3 years. This will be my last slide, and so I'll finish up, but it's a very good study carried out by Paul Youngstich in his master's thesis with Dr. Jeff Shano and Dr. Bart Lardner from the University of Saskatchewan. They looked at winter feeding with bale processing laid on the ground, or bale grazing compared to raw manure. Effectively, they increased the nutrient supply of nitrogen following the the year following grazing, significantly higher than the control or spread manure. Phosphorus was increased by manure more than the bale systems. And over a two-year period with an old Russian wild ryegrass stand increased the yield more with bale grazing or more with bale processing than grazing. So I'll close off there. Extended grazing practices reduce cost significantly, a lot, to the extent that when we did a third-party study on the research benefit to this, it was 170-1. Managing quality characteristics in the winter are extremely important versus the cow requirement, and several aspects of sustainability may be impacted. Thank you.
Thank you for the insight into Winterfell. That was a joke, Darren.
I know.
I didn't get any response. He criticizes me for not saying anything, and then I do, and falls on deaf ears. So, okay. So we now have time for discussion. So you're welcome to ask any of our speakers who gave great talks across this wide range of environments. So we have time for a discussion, then we also have the break, so we have about 10 minutes. Any questions for any of our speakers? James? You can come up here if you want to use speak, if that helps.
We have looked at Bermuda grass as well early on. However, Bermuda grass is a lot more expensive to establish, and since we're every 2 years, every year we're establishing some of the Bahia grass, so we have not gone that route as far as using it for grazing, although it could work out very well. But the essentially the benefits are very similar.
David, I have one for on that Bahia grass. Does it, because you rotate to peanut, right? Is there a long? Does it take a long time to break down or to mineralize?
The question was on Bahia grass. Does it take a long time to break down or mineralize? Actually, what we do is 2 year old Bahia grass. It's not hardly 2 years old. We cull it out in the fall. We will normally use a no till drill and plant oats and rye over the top of it. Sometimes if it's rough, and we may run a harrow to smooth it before we no-till the oats and rye into it. But then we strip-till the peanuts into Bahia grass, and as we showed some of the data, we have 20,000 pounds of root mass there, which is 6-7 times more than the oats and rye. And so when you dig peanuts, you have to dig deeper to get the peanuts, and it's a slower process than what farmers would do if they were planting into a just straight oats and rye, or straight no-tilling into an annual crop. So it does take a lot of management, and any time you put cattle into a system, it doubles and triples the labor and everything else. So it does take a team of people, a team of scientists and students to work on a systems project. Yes, sir.
Did you say that the
Bahia
grass reduces the nematode population?
Bahia grass reduces nematode populations dramatically, and the southern root knot, most of the nematodes, the grass nematodes, the stings and lesions and stubby root, it does not. But our main row crop, nematodes, the southern root knot, the peanut root knot, the reniform nematode, which impacts cotton. It does a tremendous job. Pardon? The mechanism, actually, I don't know if we, I don't see the nematologist that works with us, and no, I really do not know. There's a lot of speculation, and I don't know that that's ever been fully, you know, I don't know.
Okay, the question is about crop rotation. And that's a really, really good question. What do we plant afterwards, and what is the response to the crop that follows? And we have not been able to get funding to do that kind of work, but it's really, really necessary work to have done. Our money has been really directed toward, has, you know, any time you can include an animal in a project and you're applying to an animal group, you will get money, so grazing is emphasized. And the comment was made, the amount of labor that's required to conduct these kinds of work, integrated work, is immense. We have plans to do that economic, that kind of rotation type work. It's important. What happens on the farm is that certain pieces of land are more conducive for this than others, because they're near corral systems, they have water systems, and so on. What you tend to get is barley on barley and corn on corn.
Jose.
David, are you aware of any regulatory issues of any cattle on vegetable production system? Is there any lag time that you should wait until you can plant anything?
Yeah, so the question is about if you were grazing in those vegetable systems, any regulations with animal removal. Organic systems, yes, it would be 90 days, 90 to 120 days, depending on the crop you're following with. Conventionally, I think there would be no regulations unless your buyer requires that through GAP certification, which then there's probably similar lag times between when the livestock are there and when you can harvest that crop, just for food safety reasons. Yeah. Good question.